Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam McNeil, and today I'm in conversation with Virginia Commonwealth University professor, Dr. Michael Dickinson, and we're on here to talk about his new book, first book, Almost Dead, Slavery and Social Rebirth in the Black Urban Atlantic from 1680 to 1807. And so, Dr. Dickinson, my brother, how you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's definitely an honor.
Good, man. Well, hey, I'm definitely glad that we can, you know, make this work, man. You know, very busy guy and, you know, really excited to talk today, man. So, you know, I'm interested to start here with our conversation. You know, can you talk to us about your experiences that led you to this particular book, Almost Dead? You know, because I know this is your first book and, you know, I look forward to being in your seat at the end of the decade. And so, you know, take us back to the Genesis story. And I'm intentionally using that word there for this book, man. So let's start there.
Certainly. So there are a number of sort of Genesis, mini Genesis stories within the larger Genesis story, thinking about some of the ideological foundations of the book and the geographic scope. But I'm going to direct my attention, because I think really where the project took off was when I was a grad student in an archive. And I was really interested about some of these the connections between port cities and lived realities of port cities with these Black communities, enslaved communities that were being created in order to survive. And so I was fascinated by that and looking at some of these commercial connections. And I stumbled upon the narrative of Jeffrey Brace. And that was really when the project took a more human turn. And it was less about the commercial connections and more about the lived experience of what it means to be within these urban networks and forced to rebuild, recreate, and try to and try to survive.
And so to follow up on that too, you know, the something that I've been thinking about a lot, and this goes to what we had spoken about before we got started, because we share an advisor, Dr. Eric Armstrong Dunbar. Hello, I know you're listening. And I've been really thinking a lot about survival. And you know, I think it's in a way very topical to our moment, because, you know, we're not a post-pandemic society yet. And my dissertation project comes out of living through the pandemic's earliest chapters, the current one, the COVID-19 one. And so I'm also interested to know why survival as a rooting interest, not, you know, not rooting like cheer cheer, but like rooting you. Why was that in particular, going back to your experiences in graduate school at the University of Delaware, why was that an interesting, why was that a rooting interest for you? For this topic, why survival?
So great question. I will connect this with your background here, because one of the, certainly the ideological foundation comes with Stephanie Smallwood's work on saltwater slavery. And I first encountered that book in Professor Dunbar's class many, many years ago. A special shout out to the very brilliant Dr. Eric Armstrong Dunbar. And so really interacting with Smallwood's work, Smallwood really envisions the processes of capture, of forced migration, of this collective process of commodification as systematic, but also human, right? And so she uses this idea of social rebirth to help us understand how enslaved peoples are experiencing this, are contending against against oppression, are trying to survive within this Atlantic context. But I mean, I remember reading, and she sort of leaves the study at the arrival in the Americas. And so, as a grad student, as a student, I was very curious about what's next, right? How do we understand this idea of social rebirth and in these port cities of the Atlantic to really see how this unfolds once they are employed in these forced labor systems, right? And their lives in the Americas begin. How do we see that actually unfold? And so that really helped me to see this story of survival in ways that feature the Atlantic, feature urban centers, but also, and most importantly, feature the lived experiences of enslaved individuals. Because I think what we do see is you mentioned survival, right, and the pandemic and some of these very real moments of trauma and suffering. But I think that that's only part of the story, right? The other part of the story is the humanity within that, right? The ability to survive within oppression, within these emotional trying, taxing experiences. Of course, a pandemic is not slavery. Let's not equate the two. But I think the larger point is that that two things can be true at the same time, right? We can have these moments of trauma, suffering, and the like, but it's also accompanied by resilience and human beings' ability to endure.
And I think this is a great segue to talk about another book that, you know, the listeners can't see, but, you know, they can hear me flap the pages of it. And the book that I'm flapping the pages about is Orlando Patterson's Slavery and Social Death, A Comparative Study, that I have here right now with your book, Almost Dead. And so it's for many of our listeners to New Books in African American Studies, Orlando Patterson's Slavery and Social Death, it might not be, it's probably not a new book to them. And so they may have maybe seen a closeness with Almost Dead. And so that's certainly not unintentional. So with that being said, how does Almost Dead engage with Patterson? And also take us back to some of the earliest times when you actually read Slavery and Social Death as well, which is a book that obviously Smallwood engages with her work too.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right. Smallwood engages with Orlando Patterson's argument of social death. And ironically enough, I actually engaged with and read Slavery and Social Death after reading Saltwater Slavery, right? Seeing these references to the idea of social death and wanting to really wrap my head around this argument and the ideological foundations of social death. And I will say, I mean, the work of Orlando Patterson is essential, right, to the study of slavery and the historiography of slavery. He's a brilliant scholar, and Slavery and Social Death is just one of his multiple studies. And really thinking about slavery in a comparative framework and thinking about, you know, what it means to be enslaved from a theoretical perspective. So it's essential. But I think we can appreciate and laud what Orlando Patterson is trying to do with this concept of social death, which is, you know, help us to understand the impact of slavery on the realities of those enslaved from a social context, from a cultural context, and the like. The argument I make in my book is that that only tells us part of the story, right? That if we think of social death as sort of this fixed state of being, it belies a more nuanced understanding of the humanities of those enslaved, meaning that they are actively working to rebuild, right? To keep these connections to West Africa, to create new kinship and community ties. They're constantly working to maintain their humanity, and that does not negate the trauma, right? That I think Orlando Patterson was trying to point to and highlight, and in various ways with this idea of social death. But I think it really gives us a more dynamic portrait of what these lived experiences are like. And I think that's where Stephanie Smallwood's trying to push our attention to with this idea of social rebirth. And I'm trying to really help us understand that, I think, more deeply in once we get into these cities of the Atlantic.
And thinking about the process of making your book, published through the University of Georgia Press's Race in the Atlantic World, 1700 to 1900 series. Can you tell us a bit about some of the biggest challenges you face while researching, writing, and ultimately constructing Almost Dead?
Certainly, they are many, right? In producing a book, especially a first book. I think the simplest answer is the pandemic itself, right? I was actually writing and collecting more material during the pandemic while it hit. And so, as you know, as our listeners likely know, the archives were by and large shut down, and it was hard to get access to books. And I had conducted much of the research already, but of course, there's always more to do. It's also, you know, it required me to have a level of ingenuity with my sources, right? So I think that's one of the bright sides to having to set during a pandemic with sources that, you know, that I've already accumulated. It forced me to think deeply and have these sources set with me in order to sort of in many ways suck the marrow out of a source and really inhabit the space of these enslaved actors and to better understand their plight, but also their resistance and their survival. And so in so much that, you know, my work was limited by the pandemic, and I think we can think about that and for other authors during the pandemic as well. I think it also forced us to see our sources more deeply and really invest in those sources that we already had in ways that I think are very generative and very important in trying to recreate the world of slavery.
And one of the key sources you had actually mentioned before, dealing with Jeffrey Brace, one of the enslaved actors in Almost Dead. So can you actually talk to the audience a bit about the role that and some folks say ex-slave narrators and their narratives played in Almost Dead's creation for you? Because it seemed like you you leaned on many of them for your work too. So take us into the role that they played.
Certainly. So for our listeners, the actual title of the book is taken from Jeffrey Brace's narrative. He was an enslaved man. He was a Revolutionary War veteran, and he has this incredible testimony. And there's this quote that he gives while he's in Bridgetown, Barbados, and he's suffering, and he tells another enslaved man who's checking on him, and he says, you know, I'm almost dead. And the argument I make in the book is that he's speaking, of course, to a physical reality, but also a social, a cultural, a psychological reality, right? When we think about the process of commodification and trying to build upon what is lost, right, in forced migration from West Africa. And so really these testimonies, not only Jeffrey Brace, but there are a number of figures who are really featured in the book that help us to understand what it means to see this process not from an ideological perspective, or not merely from a theoretical perspective, right, but from a lived perspective of what it means to try to hold on to memories of West African culture, what it means to hold on to memories of loved ones, what it means to try and create these kinship connections, what it means to try and create these new community connections that these testimonies really shed light upon. And to illustrate that, I mean, the chapters, the titles of the book are actually quotes from testimonies of enslaved folks that help us, I think, to think really thematically about how does this process of social rebirth unfold and how do we better understand it through the eyes of those enslaved? Because I think it's difficult for us to really inhabit that space, but their words and their deeds and their testimonies really help us to really see these larger social processes in very real ways that are often difficult for us to wrap our heads around as folks in the time period in which we live.
Race, space, geography, just generally speaking, also play, I would say, important roles in Almost Dead. And so with that being said, can you actually detail for the listeners the differences you found in enslaved experiences of folks in urban environments that are the primary focus of your study and folks who are living and being enslaved in more rural areas, which are probably more of the, if people close their eyes and think about the visual culture of enslavement, that the rural areas are usually the areas that they're thinking about. So detail the differences for the listeners, if you can, or if
right. So you're right. And when we think about, at least in the popular imagination, slavery, we think about, you know, the rural plantation. And so a part of what I'm trying to do with the book is really help us to think about slavery, not necessarily limited to these rural plantations, but also in terms of movement in the Atlantic and thinking about the mainland and the Caribbean. And so just sort of broad strokes, I mean, we're thinking about in terms of differences between urban slavery and plantation slavery, the types of labor, right, that is being undertaken. We can also think about the proximity of loved ones, right, especially on plantations where there are large enslaved populations. It's a higher probability to have loved ones closer, as well as the ability to hold on to West African culture, right, because there is these larger close populations of enslaved individuals within a certain space, right, versus an urban setting where they're by and large more spread out. The slave holdings or holdings of slaveholders are more limited. And so also we can talk about, you know, the ability to be mobile in urban settings, that there is there in many ways there is some more mobility or options for mobility by and large, right? And so these are broad strokes as well. And we can also think about the spread of information, right? This is where Julia Scott's, you know, The Common Wind comes into play, right? That these port cities are really essential in spreading information, that these enslaved folks are tend to be, you know, get information before, right, plan of their counterparts on plantations. And so it runs the gambit about some of these distinctions and differences. But I would like to flip this, your question, to the opposite end, because I think one of the things that the book tries to highlight, right, is that there are some very real similarities between slavery on the plantation and in urban spaces. And what I mean by that is that we oftentimes think of urban slavery as less brutal, for instance, that it provides more possibility, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, the urban slavery still revolves around and is relying upon force and fear in very real ways, right? That there's still this public nature of punishment that's necessary to have and keep the slave system intact. We can also think about the ability and efforts of enslaved individuals to hold on to West African traditions. That's present in urban spaces, just like it is on the plantation. It just looks different, right? Because the possibilities are different in terms of gathering and in terms of the frequency of being able to come together and the like. But there's still efforts to really hold on to these West African cultural traditions in urban settings in ways that I don't think we tend to really highlight as much as on the plantation. So those are a couple of ways that we actually see that there are some very real similarities between urban slavery and plantation slavery, and we can go from there as well. Thinking about, for example, brutality, right? We think about, you know, the plantation being extraordinarily brutal, but I mean, so were urban settings oftentimes, depending on who the slaveholder was and the circumstances. And so, what I think we get from that comparison and looking at, you know, these urban settings and urban slavery is an understanding of the nuances and the complexity of what it means to be enslaved on an individual basis, irrespective of geographic setting.
And first of all, thank you for flipping and reversing it, like Missy Elliott said. So I appreciate you for that one. But also, you know, you choose Philadelphia, Bridgetown, and Kingston as your three sites of study. Why did you choose those three out of all the places that you could have chosen in the Black urban Atlantic? Why did you choose those three port cities?
Yes, fair question. So, if I could take us back and give some perspective on this, I'll start with perspective on me. I'm actually from Northern Delaware, which is in many ways, as you well know, right? In many ways, a suburb of Philadelphia. And
very much.
I used to, when I was growing up, we used to go to church every Sunday right outside the city. And so, cities. I've always been fascinated by cities in the first place, Philadelphia in particular. And I was very much interested in some of these urban networks that are coming, connecting Philadelphia to the Atlantic, particularly when we think about the enslaved population that actually is living and employed in Philadelphia. Most of them come from the Caribbean, and most of them, of course, come from Bridgetown and Kingston. And so I wanted to look at this urban network to understand what it means to be enslaved as part of this, as part of the urban Atlantic. Now, I think part of what I'm trying to do is push the conversation forward with this study. I say that because, I mean, in an ideal world, perhaps maybe a couple books from now or someone, you know, down the line, a really comprehensive study, I think, would be useful, right? Including cities like New York and Charleston, right? And understanding these movements, thinking about, you know, Gregory O'Malley and this, he talks about, you know, the intercolonial slave trade, right? And so, these movements are real between these spaces and urban, these port cities are essential to that. But thinking about this network, right, of connection in Philadelphia and the Caribbean, I think we can get some sense of the representation of these populations and what it means to have movement between them, what it means to have lived experiences within these cities. And also, to what extent, right, is the larger point in this trying to understand Philadelphia as this sort of iconic hub of freedom, of Black freedom, in the late 18th century, by the late 18th century into the 19th century. And so what does that say when we think about sort of our mental schema, thinking about, you know, cities in the Caribbean versus Philadelphia, and understanding that that there are these very real connections, and that the slave system in many ways has similarities. I just talked about, you know, force and fear being tenants. And so what I wanted to highlight here is the complexity of slavery in ways that I think historians should and ought to think more deeply about. And we can only really get that and get those perspectives if we see this through the eyes of folks who are enslaved in these networks of the urban Atlantic.
And also, as a follow-up, something that I wanted to ask you about in connection to Philadelphia, and it's something that I saw, and I was like, it's very true. So can you actually talk about what your book, Almost Dead, tries to tell us about the level of brutality that slavery, that enslaved people encountered in the City of Brotherly Love? Because I think the point that you were trying to make is very important in terms of making people understand about gradations of enslavement and the brutality, but also how quote unquote northern North Atlantic cities like Philadelphia, you know, it enslaved people encountered things that enslaved people everywhere would have encountered. So can you talk more about that and unpack that?
Certainly. So I think one way we can see this, is the similarity of laws, right, that are enacted for Pennsylvania and in Philadelphia, right, in terms of governing the enslaved population. They look remarkably similar to laws throughout, you know, throughout British America in trying to regulate this enslaved population. We can think about this in terms of some of the runaway slave advertisements I look at in detail. We can think about this in terms of some of the court cases of enslaved folks being tried and some of the reprisals they face. And so the point that I'm trying to make here, and I think that your question leads us to, is that even though we think about Philadelphia, again, as a space of liberty, and we think about sort of Northern Enlightenment and the system of slavery, looking very different, right? What we can see is very real examples of, for example, public punishment, torture of enslaved individuals. That we can see that there are, of course, cruel slaveholders in Philadelphia, just like there are in spaces in the Caribbean or in the American South. And so what I think that does for us is helps us understand. For enslaved individuals, right, for these lived experiences of what it means to be enslaved, there's some very real complexity here. And if we allow our minds to limit and create sort of a broad brush about what slavery looks like in the Mid-Atlantic, for instance, compared to the Caribbean, we do a disservice to individuals who actually experience these things, extreme brutality in places like Philadelphia, that are important in understanding the impact of slavery on the lives of those enslaved.
Yeah, and like I said, like that's that point that you made also reminds me of why, you know, in the different works that I want to contribute in my career, writing about Philadelphia is always going to be there. You know, like you, it's one of my, it's a city that I'm very much fascinated by, especially after having lived in the city / lived around the city for pretty much the last 3 years up until midpoint of last year. And it's just, you know, it's a city of the Philadelphia Negro from Du Bois. And there's so many different, you know, reasons to be interested in the city. You know, obviously now sports wise, you know, they might win the Super Bowl, of course, but you know, we'll see. By the time this is published, we will know if Philadelphia and Jalen Hurts would have, you know, gone to the Super Bowl here. But you know, moving back to more New Books matters, each city that you chose is also quite different, obviously, from each other. So returning back to gradations here, and social rebirth, can you tell us about the different levels of social rebirth available to, enslaved individuals and communities in each city? Because for instance, their number of, enslaved people are obviously much different. From specifically, especially Philadelphia. So can you speak a bit about the gradations of social rebirth available to enslaved individuals and communities?
Certainly. So this is where it becomes really fascinating with this urban network, right? Because what we can do, since, you know, we know that most of the enslaved folks in Philadelphia, they come from the Caribbean, that there are slaveholders, merchants that are moving back and forth, that, you know, there are these very real connections. We call them sort of founding fathers of in Philadelphia. So many of them either come from the Caribbean or have connections to the Caribbean, right? And so what that, and of course, these populations of enslaved folks, right? Many of them are coming from the Caribbean. So what that allows us to do is sort of through these connections, be able to see, you know, how these populations, enslaved populations, engage in social rebirth to in ways that look different depending on the geographic setting. But what I mean by that, I'll give you an illustration. There's a chapter in the book that really looks at some of these cultural gatherings that happen throughout the urban Atlantic on Sundays and holidays, right? It happens in Kingston, happens in Bridgetown, happens in Philadelphia, happens in New York, right? That there are these gatherings. Now, the extent to which they gather and the frequency varies, but what that looks like is different too, from sort of an anthropological perspective, right? And this is, we can see this for those folks who have read Equiano's narrative. He talks about these gatherings in Kingston, for instance, and observing them. And he talks about, you know, the groupings. And so what we can see is if we could recreate this, right, and see this, you know, put on our time machines and go back, what we can see is likely is that these gatherings would look different in terms of heterogeneity and homogeneity, right? Meaning that because there's a larger population in Kingston on this spectrum, a larger enslaved population, Kingston has the largest in Anglo-America by the time we get to the late 18th century. We can see on this spectrum of what this looks like in Kingston, there will be more groups, and these more groups will adhere more closely to West African ethnic origins or West African ethnic groups, versus in Philadelphia, where there's a smaller enslaved population, there's a smaller West African population. So it requires a more collective, homogeneous, right, gatherings where these folks are dancing, they're playing songs, they're singing, right, and they're hearkening back to West Africa. It's a similar process, right, of trying to carry over and connecting and remembering West African traditions, trying to rebuild and reconstitute in the Americas in these urban spaces, but it looks different depending on the circumstances of population, of space, of any number of things, right? And so it this is where we sort of see the fascinating dynamic unfold within this comparative framework of these cities.
And it's something that I'm also interested in because, first of all, I really need to visit both Bridgetown and Kingston, just generally speaking. Let me ask you about that.
Sure.
Were you able to, I know obviously we've talked about Philadelphia, but in your research experiences, were you able to visit both Bridgetown and Kingston as well?
I actually did research at UWE. They have campuses in Kingston and so Mona's essentially Kingston, and the Bridgetown campus is also I stayed at, and I was able to do research at the National Archives there, and it was a delightful experience. I definitely recommend visiting if you have time, at least now or in the future. It was a wonderful experience. It's really powerful also to sort of see these spaces, right, where we can think about, you know, Equiano talks about Spring Path is where these collective celebrations happen in Kingston, for instance, right? And we can think about, you know, these we can sort of imagine, right, these large populations gathering there and trying to pinpoint what that looks like in terms of the spatial organization of the city, or both cities in this case.
Good. Because, like, I'm realizing this now while writing my dissertation, that it's there's something that you lose when you don't get the opportunity to visit mm-hmm. the places that you're writing about. Now, obviously, you can't go everywhere. Right. Necessarily, but, you know, even just for me, just thinking about, I'm like, damn, by the time this dissertation is over, I need to at least visit, like, I've been to London, but I also need to visit Nova Scotia and Halifax to see where the Black refugee migrations went. It's a dream to be able to go to, like, you know, to Sierra Leone, but, you know, that might be for post dissertation. And you know, what you doing for the book? Going to Sierra Leone, bro.
Like,
that's going to have to be it. But, you know, actually, that's actually a great build up for the next question. So one of the things that I was also interested in your book is how you're able to capture and narrate the spiritual lives of Black folks and people of African descent. And so what methods and what was your entry point for doing that in terms of, like, once again, your method, and also, you know, ultimately, how were you able to capture it? Because I think, you know, that's obviously a very important piece as well, going back to the celebrations even as well. Yeah. So how were you able to capture that for your readers?
Yes, so wonderful question, because we can't really understand social rebirth unless we really delve into the spiritual realm, right? And a useful entry point for this, as well as for, I think, all the parts of this book, and I think our conversations around slavery in general, the most useful entry points are the, you know, the lived perspectives, the words, the thoughts of enslaved individuals, right? And so we can see is that that part of the ability for these enslaved individuals to survive, a large part is this connection to the spiritual realm, whether that's through through West African traditions, or whether that's later on, we talk about in the book, through Christianity, right? And so there's, for example, a really powerful scene in Jeffrey Brace's narrative where he talks about the returning to his homeland, to his community, to his village, to his people, right, while he sleeps. He talks about all the warmth and really this powerful experience, and it's really powerful, particularly because he's having this sort of uses the term warmth multiple times. It matters because at the time he's suffering what we would qualify as torture by a new slaveholder who has him sleeping on a cold floor in mainland America during winter, right? He doesn't have proper clothing. He feels like he's going to freeze to death. But this is these dreams, these connections to a spiritual realm are able to give him the ability to survive, to push through, right? That's what really keeps him going. And so it matters to the lived realities of these enslaved individuals, whether that's through, as we just discussed, some of these collective gatherings, right? Those are spiritual connections that they're making in these collective gatherings to their ancestors and to their communities in West Africa, or whether that's funeral rites and visiting graves of loved ones, right? That what they're doing is connecting to ancestors and asking favor, asking them they're asking for favor from ancestors to try and watch over them and protect them, right? And so we can also see this, as I mentioned in the book, thinking about these Black churches that are established in first in Philadelphia in Anglo-America in the late 1700s, Mother Bethel and St. Thomas's, right? And how we think about these spiritual connections that are really important in Black worship practices in Black churches, right? And so to really enter that, I think, is also to have to dig deeply in a cultural understanding of West Africa and West African cosmologies, right? Of course, that's distinct based off of ethnic groups, but really thinking about, you know, how can we understand how enslaved Africans viewed their world, the spiritual realm, and how does that translate into later generations, right? These things that are passed down, even through and impacting, right, Black worship practices in Christianity.
And for me, that was something that, you know, I knew that you, knowing you, I knew that you wouldn't leave that stone unturned. But I'm also, you know, as someone who is also, you know, needing to not just rely on the quote unquote revolutionary era experiences of Black folks, but to always, you know, return back to West African traditions as well. Especially when understanding sovereignty and quote-unquote resistance as well. That was something that, for me, your book really helped me to think about, and also to look at sources as well. So, but obviously we've spoken about Jeffrey Brace a lot. And so to go even further, your epilogue details a remarkable story of recovery work. So I ain't gonna spoil nothing. So can you describe this remarkable experience for the listeners?
Yes, so I'll spoil it, but I think it's best read. So hopefully our listeners will pick up the copy and read the epilogue, because what I was really excited about was the I actually reached out to a couple of descendants of Jeffrey Brace, right? And I think it was really meaningful to me, because I, out of all the narratives I really examined, I think his spoke the most to me. Though, you know, there are a number of individuals, actors, testimonies that are at the forefront of the book. I mean, Jeffrey Brace's I think has the deepest impact on the book. If we had to make that analysis, right? And so it was extraordinarily exciting when two of his descendants, Miss Shauna and Miss Rhonda, they are descendants of Jeffrey Brace, and they were happy to speak with me about their ancestor. And it was especially meaningful because that they were Black women, and really thinking about the perspective, because we don't get a lot of insight into, for example, Jeffrey Brace's wife and her perspective. And so I wanted to really feature Black women in the epilogue and really understand what the perspectives of Miss Shauna and Miss Rhonda were, and thinking about their ancestor and the afterlives of slavery and the legacy of slavery, and really thinking about bringing this into the present in ways that I think are clear for them, given that their ancestor, right, left a testimony. But I think it really speaks to the effort of that recovery work for people of African descent throughout the diaspora, right? And so they had some extraordinary insights into how do we bring this into the present, and why does it matter? And I think they also give us some thoughts and on their own work to try to reconcile and deal with the legacy of slavery, with contacting, for instance, some white actors or the descendants of white actors in Brace's narrative who are extraordinarily racist to him, and go out of their way to try to steal from him and take his land, et cetera, et cetera. And they actually made efforts to try to speak to the descendants. The descendants, of course, I don't want to say of course, but unfortunately they weren't receptive to that conversation. But I mean, that is the hard work of dealing with, you know, dealing with the legacy of slavery and dealing with the afterlives of slavery, and thinking about how to push forward in ways that will be productive and deal with this very real trauma and hurt that slavery leaves behind, as well as we can talk about systemic racial oppression in the present.
And yeah, like that story of trying to converse with the people that once enslaved your ancestors, mm-hmm. and in particular, it's not even just an amorphous, you know, like we see him, we read about him, these are his experiences, and to, you know, in different spaces try to confront this particular history. It's something that so many Black people, you know, especially since the digital turn has opened up so many more opportunities for people to learn about their history. You know, it's tough. Even in one of my family areas in South Carolina, we've even been trying to do some of that work too, especially now that we can better detail the geographical space where our ancestors were enslaved, and being able to understand, like, oh wow, the whole reason why we were enslaved in this particular area is because the patriarch of this particular family was I think it was either Revolutionary War or War of 1812 veteran, and the, you know, the land grants and all that stuff. So it's, yeah, it's an ugly, you know, oftentimes an ugly, unfortunate enterprise.
It doesn't have to be, right? And so I think that's part of the takeaway from Miss Shauna and Miss Rhonda, right? They have mixed experiences, right? I mean, with some white descendants, they're able to actually have those conversations. Others aren't trying to have them at all, right? And so it's hard work. It's something that can be very successful and work toward, you know, reconciling with the past. I will say I don't think it should be incumbent upon the descendants of enslaved folks to do all of that work, right? So this is where, you know, we have a larger, you know, larger societal discussion about how do we move forward, what does this look like, and of course both sides need to come to the table, right? And it shouldn't be incumbent on just one side to do that work. But my point is that, you know, there can be successes, right? They do have some success with that. Of course, they do have less than success with some of these efforts. But I think their efforts are noble in especially given all the things they read about how their ancestor worked to fight for, you know, the country, right? He was a Revolutionary War veteran, to gain his freedom, to try and carve out a life for himself. But also even in freedom, he actually experiences an extraordinary amount of racism. There's actually a scholarship at the University of Vermont named after him, because he actually settles in Vermont. It's a social justice scholarship that was created some years back to try and reconcile, right, the racism that he experiences as a Revolutionary War veteran, even though he goes to Vermont for to sort of have chart out a life and for himself and his family, and he suffers these very real injustices in Vermont. And so thinking about, you know, how do we have those conversations in ways that are productive and push us forward as a society, though, as you mentioned, right, oftentimes that's difficult work, and sometimes it's hard work, and sometimes it's emotional work, but I think we're better for it once we're willing to engage with that work.
Well, it also makes me remember that the University of Vermont also recently had an opening in African American history at the university. So hopefully whoever gets that job is listening to this, and make sure that they incorporate Jeffrey Brace in their classroom. So who knows, they might be listening for all we know. But it also makes me think as well about, you know, overall messaging. And so for me, I'm interested to know, for you as the author, this is a book that, you know, has been I guess now over a decade in the making. And so what message do you hope readers of Almost Dead ultimately receive from engaging your ideas? What are your hopes for your readers?
So thank you for that question. I think it's a useful question to really sum things up. And so I would like the readers to take away a couple of things, or a few things. I want them to see enslaved people and the cities that they inhabited as multivalent and multidimensional. But I think more than anything, I want them to see this as a human story, right? To see how these enslaved individuals and communities, they traverse the spectrum of human emotion, and they work to resist, rebuild, they strive to endure, and they strive to really hold on to traditions in ways that are extraordinarily human. And that does not negate the suffering that they endure or the oppression that is clearly present, right? But I think it tells a fuller story of what it means to be enslaved, and reminds us of the humanity of those folks that are enslaved.
Very well. And so I have one other question before I ask you the last one. So Dr. Erica Armstrong Dunbar, author of Never Caught, The Washington's Relentless Pursuit of Their Runaway Slave Owner Judge, wrote a prominent blurb on your book, and I'm going to read it. With a brave and masterful handling of sources, Michael Lawrence Dickinson moves beyond the bodily trauma of slavery in the Black urban Atlantic and dives directly into the souls of his subjects. Almost Dead is a deeply moving and important work that centers the power of Black survival and rebirth in the early Anglo-Atlantic world. End quote. I see you smiling. I see you smiling, my brother. So tell us what Dr. Eric Armstrong Dunbar means to you, and also to this particular project as well, along with Dr. Maloba as well, who I know, you know, you worked with at the University of Delaware.
Certainly. So I'll start by thanking Dr. Dunbar for that really thoughtful and meaningful quote, given who it's coming from and some of the incredible work she has done with Never Caught and so many other of her work of recovery and examining the lived experiences of enslaved and free people of African descent. To answer your question, you're asking about my academic parents, as I would refer to them as W. Maloba and Erica Armstrong Dunbar. They have been essential in my growth as a historian, as a student, as a scholar, as a teacher. I actually met Erica when I was early in my undergraduate career, and she pulled me aside, and I was planning on going to med school, and I actually just enjoyed history as sort of a hobby, and she pulled me aside and said, you know, what if you did this for a living? And it had never occurred to me, right? And I think this is also an argument for having people that look like me in spaces of academia, right? Because that had never even crossed my mind, right? Because I believe she was my first. She was my first Black professor, right? To be able to imagine a reality where I could do this kind of work, to learn more about myself, the past of people of African descent, and really communicate those stories. And so Erica and Maloba have been essential in doing just that, fostering and helping me see what that work looks like. As well as helping me to appreciate the value of mentorship and appreciate the value of trying to make sure that stories of Black people are told, come to the fore, and are prioritized, as well as are given, you know, their due attention. And so I'm extraordinarily grateful to both of them. And I will sing their praises often, because this work, as I mentioned, if you look at the acknowledgments, it's a reflection of their hard work and investment in me, and how I sort of envision historical scholarship and how I envision, right, the importance of this kind of work and its larger potential impact on the profession, but beyond the profession as well.
Dr. Dunbar, Dr. Maloba, I know y'all hear that. I know y'all hear that, and everybody else. I love that. And, you know, I've definitely benefited, Lord knows, in a myriad of different ways from Dr. Dunbar's mentorship and care. And just, like, I remember, like, literally right before the pandemic happened, you know, I was like, I was in a rut, like real bad. And like, she noticed, she hit me up like, yo, dude, you good? And like, that was one of the first times, I was actually, we had spoken in the break area at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And I remember, honestly, we're only supposed to really talk about the, you know, some of the archives, because I was trying to write a paper, seminar paper. And I remember, like, I had a bad first semester. Like, I didn't do as well as what I should have. And like, I let that migrate into the next semester. And she was like, you good? Like above everything else, you good? And like, I think that was one of the first times ever, or at least I can ever remember, of a professor actually asking me, are you okay? And like, that to me was, you know, a pivotal moment for me as a student, as a mentee, but also as a person, because I've chosen, like, this is what I want. Like you, like she asked with you, you know, would you think about doing this for a living? And I had made that choice, and like, things were not going as well as what I wanted them to. And so that opened a door, a huge door for me to talk a bit about, like, you know, things that had come over from the other semester and how I did. And so, you know, shout out to, I think this is a great moment to show great mentorship can literally change your life.
That's very true.
Literally change lives. and how, unfortunately, on the flip side, a lack of mentorship, period, or just bad mentorship can also turn your life in another way as well. So, you know, this is a great moment to talk about mentorship.
That's very true. I think that's, I mean, so this is a moment, I think, in for our teachers out there, or instructors, professors, right, that we can see, right, the power of investing in our students, right? Because I know I pay it forward to my students, and I think this is really important, not only about, you know, the work of historical examination, right? That's important, but and of course preparation and training, but, you know, also this is mentorship done well, particularly for, you know, for our Black and Brown students, right? That really matters. I mean, full disclosure, I'm a first generation college student, and so these things really matter in terms of making sure that we are giving students the support that they need to do dynamic or conduct dynamic research and be the scholars of the next generation. And so I want to applaud that work, as you are. I think we should applaud that work for folks out there who are engaging with their students in that way and trying to be supportive in order to make sure that that these spaces in academia are as diverse as they should be, and the work of Black stories are being told and being championed in that way.
For sure. And so we're going to end this on a musical note. So last question, because I rarely work long stretches without music or something playing in the background. Went to a concert from Bilal last night. For you, if you could curate a playlist based on your book of 7 different songs for this playlist, or you can choose even more than 7. Don't let the discipline of 7 stop you here. What songs do you think would most represent Almost Dead if you were to choose this set list?
So this is an interesting question, and I think I'm gonna cheat on this. So, just background, right? And speaking of, you know, investment in people and you know, folks I am indebted to for this project and my larger career and life and everything. Those of you who read the book will likely notice I actually dedicate it to my mother. She unfortunately passed away when I was writing it. But she did leave me her record collection, which was also my grandmother's record collection. And so it spans the gambit, right? From blues to jazz to Motown to, she was a very spiritual woman, and my faith is very close to me too. So gospel and hymns, right? And so I think that really helps us, again, this spectrum of human emotion that the book really traverses, right? The suffering, but also the struggle and the love and the insistence on community building, right? That really matter and help us understand what it means to be in these spaces. So I'll leave it very broad, because that those are all very broad genres, but I think that really helps me to you know, communicate how the book works to help us understand, you know, humanity, because I think all those genres traverse humanity and our various emotional states and the like in very real ways that tell a very real story about very real human beings of African descent who struggled to survive in the Atlantic.
And I really appreciate you for that. And it also goes to show that now, whenever you listen to any of the records that you just mentioned, as always, as a way to remember your mother. And so that's a beautiful ode. And it's also a great way to even connect to the book as well, because despite people not being here, you still can have something to remember them by. And so I think that's once again a beautiful ode, and also a great way for us to close up shop on part one of our conversation, because part two will be for the next work that you're doing as well, to come on here and to converse about. And y'all, we've had the amazing opportunity to chat with Dr. Michael Lawrence Dickinson, author, of Almost Dead, Slavery and Social Rebirth in the Black Urban Atlantic from 1680 to 1807. And Brother Dickinson is an assistant professor of history at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And y'all, if you enjoy this conversation, please like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And please, you know, rate us and review us wherever you get them, so we can know how we're doing. Because how can we ever improve if we don't know where to improve from? So until next time, y'all, I'm your host of New Books of African American Studies, Adam McNeil. And once again, we had a convo with Dr. Michael Lawrence Dickinson. And until next time, y'all, be well and be good. Over and out.